Frosty walls. Walls almost like those of the Dalton home. The doorways were wider than those of any house in which he had ever lived. Some rich folks lived here once, he thought. Rich white folks. That was the way most houses on the south side were, ornate, old, stinking. Homes once of rich white people, now inhabited by Negroes, or standing dark and empty with yawning black windows. He remembered that bombs had been thrown by whites into houses like these when Negroes had first moved into the south side. He swept the disk of yellow and walked gingerly down a hall and into a room at the front of the house. It was feebly lit from the street lamps outside. He switched off the flashlight and looked round. The room had six large windows. By standing close to any of them, the streets in all four directions were visible. See, Bessie? He turned to look at her and found that she was not there. He called tensely.
Bessie!
There was no answer. He bounded to the doorway and switched on the flashlight. She was leaning against a wall, sobbing. He went to her, caught her arm, and yanked her back into the room. Come on. You got to do better than this.
I'd rather have you kill me right now, she sobbed.
Don't you say that again. She was silent. His black, open palm swept upward in a swift, narrow arc and smacked solidly against her face. You want me to wake you up? She bent her head to her knees. He caught hold of her arm again and dragged her to the window. He spoke like a man who had been running and was out of breath. Now look, all you got to do is come here tomorrow night, see? Ain't nothing going to bother you. I'm seeing everything. Don't you worry none. You just do what I say. You come here and just watch. About 12 o'clock, a car will come along. It'll be blinking its headlights, see? When it comes, you just raise this flashlight and blink it 3 times, see? Like this. Remember that. Then watch that car. It'll throw out a package. Watch that package, 'cause the money'll be in it. It'll go into the snow. Look and see if anybody's about. If you see nobody, then go and get the package and go home. But don't go straight home. Make sure nobody's watching you. Nobody's following you, see? Ride 3 or 4 streetcars and transfer fast. Get off about 5 blocks from home and look behind you as you walk, see? Now look. You can see up and down Michigan in 36. You can see if anybody's watching. I'll be in the white folks' house all day tomorrow. If they put anybody out to watch, I'll let you know not to come.
Beggar.
Come on now.
Take me home.
You going to do it? She did not answer. You already in it, he said. You got part of the money.
I reckon it don't make no difference, she sighed.
It'll be easy.
It won't. I get caught. But it don't make no difference. I'm lost anyhow. I was lost when I took up with you. I'm lost and it don't matter.
Come on. He led her back to the car stop. He said nothing as they waited in the whirling snow. When he heard the car coming, he took her purse from her, opened it, and put the flashlight inside. The car stopped. He helped her on, put 7 cents in her trembling hand, and stood in the snow watching her black face through the window, white with ice, as the car moved off slowly through the night.
This ends Disc 6. Native Son, Disc 7.
He walked to Dalton's through the snow. His right hand was in his coat pocket, his fingers about the kidnap note. When he reached the driveway, he looked about the street carefully. There was no one. He looked at the house. It was white, huge, silent. He walked up the steps and stood in front of the door. He waited a moment to see what would happen. So deeply conscious was he of violating dangerous taboo that he felt the very air or sky would suddenly speak. commanding him to stop. He was sailing fast in the face of a cold wind that all but sucked his breath from him, but he liked it. Around him were silence and night and snow falling, falling as though it had fallen from the beginning of time and would always fall till the end of the world. He took the letter out of his pocket and slipped it under the door. Turning, he ran down the steps and round the house.
I done it now.
They'll see it tonight or in the morning. He went to the basement door, opened it, and looked inside. No one was there. Like an enraged beast, the furnace throbbed with heat, suffusing a red glare over everything. He stood in front of the cracks and watched the restless embers. Had Mary burned completely? He wanted to poke around in the coals to see, but dared not. He flinched from it even in thought. He pulled the lever for more coal, then went to his room. When he stretched out on his bed in the dark, he found that his whole body was trembling. He was cold and hungry. While lying there shaking, a hot bath of fear, hotter than his blood, engulfed him, bringing him to his feet. He stood in the middle of the floor, seeing vivid images of his gloves, his pencil, and paper. How on earth had he forgotten them? He had to burn them. He would do it right now. He pulled on the light and went to his overcoat and got the gloves and pencil and paper and stuffed them into his shirt. He went to the door, listened a moment, then went into the hall and down the stairs to the furnace. He stood a moment before the gleaming cracks. Hurriedly, he opened the door and dumped the gloves and pencil and paper in. He watched them smoke, blaze. He closed the door and heard them burn in a furious whirlwind of draft. A strange sensation enveloped him. Something tingled in his stomach and on his scalp. His knees wobbled, giving way. He stumbled to the wall and leaned against it weakly. A wave of numbness spread fanwise from his stomach over his entire body, including his head and eyes, making his mouth gap. Strength ebbed from him. He sank to his knees and pressed his fingers to the floor to keep from tumbling over. An organic sense of dread seized him. His teeth chattered, and he felt sweat sliding down his armpits and back. He groaned, holding as still as possible. His vision was blurred, but gradually it cleared. Again he saw the furnace. Then he realized that he had been on the verge of collapse. Soon the glare and drone of the fire came to his eyes and ears. He closed his mouth and gritted his teeth. The peculiar, paralyzing numbness was leaving. When he was strong enough to stand without support, he rose to his feet and wiped his forehead on his sleeve. He had strained himself from a too long lack of sleep and food, and the excitement was sapping his energy. He should go to the kitchen and ask for his dinner. Surely, he should not starve like this. He mounted the steps to the door and knocked timidly. There was no answer. He turned the knob and pushed the door in and saw the kitchen flooded with light. On a table were spread several white napkins, under which was something that looked like plates of food. He stood gazing at it, then went to the table and lifted the corners of the napkins. There were sliced bread and steak, and fried potatoes, and gravy and string beans and spinach, and a huge piece of chocolate cake. His mouth watered. Was this for him? He wondered if Peggy was around. Ought he try to find her? But he disliked the thought of looking for her. That would bring attention to himself, something which he hated. He stood in the kitchen, wondering if he ought to eat, but afraid to do so. He rested his black fingers on the edge of the white table, and a silent laugh burst from his parted lips as he saw himself for a split second in a lurid, objective light. He had killed a rich white girl, and had burned her body after cutting her head off, and had lied to throw the blame on someone else, and had written a kidnap note demanding $10,000, and yet he stood here, afraid to touch food on the table. Food, which undoubtedly was his own. bigger.
Huh?
He answered before he knew who had called. Where have you been? Your dinner's been waiting for you since 5 o'clock. There's a chair. Eat as much as you want.
He stopped listening. In Peggy's hand was the kidnap note.
I'll heat your coffee. Go ahead and eat.
Had she opened it? Did she know what was in it?
No.
The envelope was still sealed. She came to the table and removed the napkins. His knees were shaking with excitement, and sweat broke out in his forehead. His skin felt as though it were puckering up from a blast of heat.
Don't you want the steak warmed?
The question reached him from far away, and he shook his head without really knowing what she meant.
Don't you feel well?
This is all right, he murmured.
You oughtn't starve yourself that way.
I wasn't hungry.
You're hungrier than you think, she said.
She set a cup and saucer at his plate, then laid the letter on the edge of the table. It held his attention as though it were a steel magnet and his eyes were iron. She got the coffee pot and poured his cup full. No doubt, she had just gotten the letter from under the door and had not yet had time to give it to Mr. Dalton. She placed a small jar of cream at his plate and took up the letter again.
I've got to give this to Mr. Dalton, she said. I'll be back in a moment.
Yes'm, he whispered. She left. He stopped chewing and stared before him, his mouth dry. But he had to eat. Not to eat now would create suspicion. He shoved the food in and chewed each mouthful a while, then washed it down with swallows of hot coffee. When the coffee gave out, he used cold water. He strained his ears to catch sounds, but none came. Then the door swung in silently, and Peggy came back. He could see nothing in her round red face. Out of the corners of his eyes, he watched her go to the stove and putter with pots and pans.
Want more coffee?
No.
You ain't scared of all this trouble we're having round here, are you, Bigger?
Oh, no. He said, wondering if something in his manner had made her ask that.
That poor Mary, Peggy sighed. She acts like such a ninny. Imagine, a girl keeping her parents worried sick all the time. But there are children for you these days.
He hurried with his eating, saying nothing. He wanted to get out of the kitchen. The thing was in the open now. Not all of it, but some of it. Nobody knew about Mary yet. He saw in his mind a picture of the Dalton family, distraught and horrified when they found that Mary was kidnapped. That would put them a certain distance from him. They would think that white men did it. They would never think that a black, timid Negro did that. They would go after Jan. The red he had signed to the letter, and the hammer and curving knife would make them look for communists.
You got enough?
Yes'm.
You better clean the ashes out of the furnace in the morning, Bigger.
Yes'm.
And be ready for Mr. Dalton at 8.
Yes'm.
Your room all right?
Yes'm. The door swung in violently. Bigger started in fright. Mr. Dalton came into the kitchen, his face ashy. He stared at Peggy, and Peggy, holding a dish towel in her hand, stared at him. In Mr. Dalton's hand was the letter, opened.
What's the matter, Mr. Dalton?
Who gave you this?
What?
This letter.
Why, nobody. I got it from the door.
When?
A few minutes ago. Anything wrong?
Mr. Dalton looked round the entire kitchen. Not at anything in particular, but just round the entire stretch of four walls, his eyes wide and unseeing. He looked back at Peggy. It was as if he had thrown himself upon her mercy, was waiting for her to say some word that would take the horror away.
Well, what's the matter, Mr. Dalton? Peggy asked again. But before Mr. Dalton could answer, Mrs. Dalton groped her way into the kitchen, her white hands held high. Bigger watched her fingers tremble through the air till they touched Mr. Dalton's shoulder. They gripped his coat, hard enough to tear it from his body. Bigger, without moving an eyelid, felt his skin grow hot and his muscles stiffen.
Henry! Henry!
Mrs. Dalton called.
What's the matter?
Mr. Dalton did not hear her. He still stared at Peggy. Did you see who left this letter?
No, Mr. Dalton.
You, Bigger?
No, sir,
he whispered, his mouth full of dry food.
Henry, tell me, please, for heaven's sake.
Mr. Dalton put his arm about Mrs. Dalton's waist and held her close to him.
It's about Mary. She.
What? Where is she?
They got her. They kidnapped her.
Henry, no!
Mrs. Dalton screamed.
Oh, no!
Peggy whimpered, running to Mr. Dalton.
My baby!
Mrs. Dalton sobbed.
She's been kidnapped,
Mr. Dalton said, as though he had to say the words over again to convince himself. Bigger's eyes were wide, taking in all three of them in one constantly roving glance. Mrs. Dalton continued to sob, and Peggy sank into a chair, her face in her hands. Then she sprang up and ran out of the room, crying,
Lord, don't let them kill her!
Mrs. Dalton swayed. Mr. Dalton lifted her and staggered, trying to get her through the door. As he watched Mr. Dalton, there flashed through Bigger's mind a quick image of how he had lifted Mary's body in his arms the night before. He rose and held the door open for Mr. Dalton, and watched him walk unsteadily down the dim hallway with Mrs. Dalton in his arms. He was alone in the kitchen now. Again, the thought that he had the chance to walk out of here and be clear of it all came to him, and again, he brushed it aside. He was tensely eager to stay and see how it would all end, even if that end swallowed him in blackness. He felt that he was living upon a high pinnacle where bracing winds whipped about him. There came to his ears a muffled sound of sobs. Then suddenly there was silence. What's happening? Would Mr. Dalton phone the police now? He strained to listen, but no sounds came. He went to the door and took a few steps into the hallway. There were still no sounds. He looked about to make sure that no one was watching him, then crept on tiptoe down the hall. He heard voices. Mr. Dalton was talking to someone. He crept farther. Yes, he could hear.
I want to talk to Britton, please.
Mr. Dalton was phoning.
Come right over, please. Yes, at once, something awful has happened. I don't want to talk about it over the phone.
That meant that when Britton came back, he would be questioned again.
Yes, right away. I'll be waiting.
He had to get back to his room. He tiptoed along the hall, through the kitchen, down the steps, and into the basement. The torrid cracks of the furnace gleamed in the crimson darkness, and he heard the throaty undertone of the draft devouring the air. Was she burnt? But even if she were not, who would think of looking in the furnace for her? He went to his room, into the closet, closed the door, and listened. Silence. He came out, left the door open, and in order to get to the closet quickly and without sound, pulled off his shoes. He lay again on the bed, his mind whirling, with images born of a multitude of impulses. He could run away. He could remain. He could even go down and confess what he had done. The mere thought that these avenues of action were open to him made him feel free, that his life was his, that he held his future in his hands. But they would never think that he had done it.
not a meek black boy like him. He bounded off the bed, listening, thinking that he had heard voices. He had been so deeply taken up with his own thoughts that he did not know if he had actually heard anything or had imagined